This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanisan and Noelle Lim. It is 6 a.m. Friday, the 11th of September. And guys, can I just say, I'm really happy that it's Friday. Not that I don't enjoy being in studio with you guys, but something, it's just nice to somehow wake up on a weekend without anything to do.
Nowhere to go.
Not to say that we all don't have responsibilities, right? But at the same time, it's nice to not have to wake up at 4:30 in the morning.
Yes. You know what I think we need? We need a jar where every time someone says, I look forward to the weekend, you put 5 ringgit in that jar. You know,
I think it's a bit expensive, lah.
Exactly, that's the point.
Everyone's going to have a depressing Friday.
This is meant to create habits, or in this case, break certain habits of us saying certain things so early in the morning.
I'm just going to tell you now, the jar's going to disappear if you institute it. I will protect it.
Okay,
you will protect it.
You know, but Lynn, you know, we've got a pretty solid show today, and the breakfast grill today is a pretty hot looking one.
Yes, it is. So I'm going to be speaking with the Deputy Youth and Sports Minister, Wan Ahmad Faizal Wan Ahmad Kamal, later on after the 8 o'clock news bulletin. And we're going to be talking about some controversy that he's faced recently over the issue of support letters. We're going to be talking about the role of youth wings in our current political landscape. So it's going to be a very interesting conversation. Be sure to tune in. But of course, that's about 2 hours in our future. In our immediate future, what are we going to be talking about, Noelle?
At 6:30, something on COVID vaccine. And then if we have time, we'll talk about ByteDance and their US deadline for TikTok.
Yeah, it's coming up soon. So I wonder whether anyone has come in to save the company, or at least in the US, the US division. You know, towards the end of the hour, we always take a look at the local local papers. A lot of news around Sabah nominations. We'll get into that. And some other political news. Not that the grill is, I'm pretty sure the grill is enough of political news for today. But that's towards the end of the hour. Stick around till then if you want to hear the local side of things. But in about 15-20 minutes, we're going to get into the impact of COVID-19 on the business ecosystems around office buildings. I'm sure if you're only half capacity in an office, the ecosystem, the businesses, the garai-garai that have set up around there are also probably getting half business at this point. So how are they keeping up, and can they survive?
If you want to weigh in on our conversations, remember you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some music coming up for you, and then we'll be tackling the subject of whether or not a new adaptability quotient should be the name of the game. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Benny and the Jets by Elton John, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noelle. Now, you know, in this new day and age, when the working life is looking very different to how it did 2 years ago, right? And it's changed very quickly. And are you able to adapt to that change? I think your ability to do that is probably going to govern how well you land on your feet, you know, at the end of this COVID-19 pandemic era, whenever that may be. To that end, there has been a term mooted to go along with the IQs and the EQs of the world. It's also called the AQ, or the adaptability quotient. And it's trying to measure how successful you will be over time amidst your changing surroundings. I think all of us have really had to see our adaptability quotient rise by sheer we didn't have any other choice when COVID-19 hit.
So we started with IQ, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. and then what became popular was EQ, emotional quotient. And I still feel that EQ especially is still very important, right? And mm-hmm. in some sense also that feeds into AQ, which is our ability to unlearn, to overcome adversity, to change, you know, especially changing with the way how we work and live, I have to say it, right? You know, adapting to technology, and also being able to go with the flow, and what some people would like to say, roll with the punches, right? And this applies to even whether you're a fresh graduate all the way up to, you know, if you're a CEO.
Yeah, I think as the years go by, we're seeing this acceleration get even faster, right? It's the how much life has changed, or the work life has changed over the last 10 years is starkly different from what it changed, what it was like the decade before and the decade before that. It's just getting faster and faster. And that's why we're seeing all this disruption in work, in jobs. There's this one IBM study that this BBC article cites that says that over the next 3 years, 120 million people in the world's 12 largest economies may need to be reskilled because of automation. And this is the kind of thing that we're worried about. It's the kind of thing that we're taking a look. Just to take a note, this article was published last year. Mm-hmm. So this is then, in the next 2 years, we expect 120 million people to be in need of upskilling. This was before the pandemic. So now I wonder what kind of numbers would come out of this.
Yeah, because I guess at the end of the day, this is really your ability to be flexible and to be able to problem solve in the face of adversity. And even before the pandemic kind of took over the entire narrative, people were talking about the changing nature of digitalization, artificial intelligence, what all of these things are going to mean for the average working adult, right? Who, whether or not you need to upskill in order to keep your job in 10 years' time. And then lo and behold, a disease swept over the entire world and threw all of that out of the window. But that doesn't mean that it's not relevant, because eventually we're going to go back to some semblance of normalcy. And all of these problems will still be there. The fact that COVID-19 technology has also accelerated during this period to fill in the gaps that we've had to leave because we haven't been able to physically work from our office. That's going to add another element to the things that we have to adapt to once the pandemic's over.
So this is a long telling story. I'm not sure if I'm using that phrase correctly, but this is a thing that's been going on for a long time. People are concerned about losing jobs. Then when you look at IQ is the most easily replaced by technology, mm-hmm. right? It's what is it? It's math, it's logic, it's analytical skills, basic analytical skills. That's where AI and machine learning is going to come and replace the human being in those roles, right? Unless it's like a very vocational job like plumbing or mechanics, that's a bit different for now. So these are the things that your long-term ability to stay in your job is going to depend on your human capacities. Your ability to adapt is one thing, because computers still require programming. Whatever said and done, they need to be programmed to think about different things. It's why self-driving cars are taking so long to really, really take off. And then the other one is emotional quotient, the ability to understand and empathize with what's going on around you. Now, this is why Andrew Yang, the former presidential nominee, Democratic nominee, came up with the idea of a freedom dividend or UBI, because so many people at basic jobs are going to get replaced over the next few years. And we feasibly, realistically, cannot replace those jobs. One of the biggest jobs in the US is retail, cashiers. If we go e-commerce, if people start doing automatic checkout, where are these people going to get placed? Are we going to upskill them in a matter of a year or two? That's not feasible.
We saw that on a small scale even here at parking lots, right? So parking lot attendants have been phased out almost entirely. I can't remember the last time I saw one in person, because we all use autopay machines.
Yeah, so what's the long-term game here? I mean, upskilling is a very long-term strategy. I don't know how it works in the near term.
Yeah, so how do you then increase AQ, right? So I think one of them is, one of the things to do is to be comfortable with the unknown and with uncertainty. And then how do you get to that state, right? I think it's about not being too hung up by maybe our own ideas, our thoughts, our viewpoints, because sometimes the desire to stick to our points is because we are afraid of the unknown, right? Mm-hmm. So I think now is how do you be more open-minded to incorporate new ideas?
Yeah, so this article does talk about ways to boost your adaptability, because that's one of the good things about an adaptability quotient, that you can increase it over time. And I think one of the biggest tips here is to ask those uncomfortable questions, to normalize fear, to develop courage, because in the long run, that may serve you well. So let us know what you think about this. Have you been able to adapt? Have you been able to build up your adaptability quotient in the past few months? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up for you, and then we're looking at the effect of all these closed offices on the ecosystems around them. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Michael Jackson with Rock With You, and you're listening to The Morning Run, rocking with you this morning, Lynn, Roshan and Noel. Now, we have another article from BBC Work Life also in front of us this morning, and it's talking about the ripple effects that we've seen from office buildings closing as a result of COVID-19. Now, in a lot of countries, including Malaysia, I think a lot of activities have resumed, so people are able to move around, albeit with physical distancing measures in place, mask wearing, so on. But a lot of offices, including BFM, are still on some form of business contingency planning, right? And what kind of an effect does that have on the restaurants, the cafes, the small sundry shops that are typically centered around these main office buildings? So 1 o'clock, for example, is usually the peak lunch rush. But for a lot of people, that lunch rush has halved, if not more, because it's only half the people in the buildings these days.
Yeah, I have friends who work in some of the big four auditing firms, and they are either still working at home or at very least minimally going into the office. So these are massive corporate buildings, right? I think the PwC building is in KL Central. So if workers aren't going there, and let's say the other banking places aren't as well, this will impact the ability for other people, for the business ecosystems that have built around those companies. I think what really reminds me of this is when I was in Singapore and I was in the CBD on a weekend, and it was just empty. It was dead. There was no cafe open because they all catered towards the work week. Now this is a perpetual weekend for the businesses that have been catered and built around all these office buildings that we have.
Yeah, so with offices closed, in fact, just looking at the stock market, office REITs have actually lagged in the market compared to other REITs. But the point is here, the surrounding businesses are affected. So, you find empty food courts, just the lone security guard walking around, cafes are also closed. And I was in an office building recently in KL. I had an appointment and I needed to see someone there, and the building was just so dead, right? I mean, it was a very nice building, but it was just so quiet. And I think to myself, I really wish we can just go back to normal life as soon as we can. So that's the situation in office buildings. But I'm also reading articles now that co-working spaces could be a beneficiary from this as offices scale down. Mm. And they just take up maybe satellite offices in co-working spaces. Or people are working at home and they're getting really bored and tired, and maybe they want to get away from their screaming kids. And so they would just park themselves in some co-working space. So I think like neighborhood co-working spaces, at least in the US and UK, there's been some interest there.
Yeah, and I think there's also been some talk about how actually office spaces may not really suffer as a result of the pandemic, because with distancing measures in place, even if you do have half the office in at any one time, you're still going to need the same amount of space as you would have with double the people in a previous non-COVID lifetime, right? But, this is not just also about the restaurants that surround an office. It's about, like, for example, the retailers. Like, I went to my dentist recently, and the dentist that I go to is surrounded by a lot of other office buildings, and they offer like half-hour teeth whitening services, those kinds of things that are basically catered for people in the office buildings to walk down during their lunch break, do whatever procedure they need to do, still have time to eat, and then go back to work. And obviously, all of those cases have just dropped off. They're just not happening because nobody is, not a lot of people are working in those office buildings surrounding. So now they're only open for essential cases, similar to how a lot of hospitals have, at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, shelved everything but the most essential of surgeries. But, I think the example that was given to us once of elective surgeries in the UK were like things like a hip replacement. If you fall down, you break your hip, your life's not in danger. So it's considered an elective surgery, but you are in pain. Your quality of life is impacted.
That's not good. That's a pretty depressing
it's quite
note.
Dire, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's how we've reprioritized certain things as well, right? And, just when we take a look, so I mean, Noel, you were talking about the co-working spaces, right? I've got this article open up on Bloomberg and how American Express has begun reopening offices in New York and London, but it's only at a 10% capacity at this point. And they're going to continue their work from home policy, the temporary work from home policy, up till June 2021. They've extended it. Now, they've got 30 locations. They've opened up 30 locations, though, mostly in Asia and Europe. So this is basically areas where they're seeing the virus contain, get better containment of the virus. But if we see more acceptance, I mean, we've seen the tech companies, right, the Googles and the Facebooks saying that they're going to have a work-from-home arrangement indefinitely. So how does that? That basically fragments the business economy that would normally be centralized. Maybe this benefits the delivery players, right? So because now people have to get their food to them. But another story I've actually heard from some of my friends who are back to work, even if the office is full or half full, is that some of the bosses, some of them are not allowed to go out to buy lunch or coffee. That you got to bring your food in. Yeah, these are actually stories that I've heard because they are paranoid or concerned about the employees mingling outside. But at some point, you've got to trust some SOPs, right? Banning people from or highly discouraging people from going out to buy lunch is then you're now assuming that they can pack lunch and bring to work.
Or they order the food panda.
Or they order food in, right? But you know, a lot of these friends of mine are like lawyers who barely have any time to do anything else as it is. So these are all the different things. They could use a bit of EQ, I think, in this situation.
Yes, some common sense, right? So my friend whose daughter just graduated, I think she finished her PhD in the US. She got a job at Amazon in Seattle. And so she, from day one, had to start working from home. So as a fresh graduate, I mean, although with a PhD, you know, that's how you're starting your career, right, at home. And I'm not sure whether that's really the best thing sometimes. And her boss has already told her that it might be a permanent arrangement that she will have to work from home.
So your friend was a fresh grad with a PhD. I don't think that counts as a fresh grad anymore. That's a high, massive inflation factor to all the other fresh grads who are out there.
I mean, if you
can
do undergraduate, master's, and PhD, you haven't worked. You are a fresh grad, right?
Shouldn't you like, I don't know, there has to be a new term for that, a senior fresh grad.
A senior graduate,
because, I mean, it really does. Someone who's come up with a bachelor's like I did a few years ago, and then I'm a fresh grad and I'm comparing myself to someone who's come up with a PhD, that's pretty demoralizing.
Yeah, but it also does like raise the question of, as you mentioned, you know, for someone who is just coming into the workforce and their only experience is going to be work from home for the foreseeable future, what is that going to do to these business ecosystems? Because it's also about the habits that we build. You know, if we come out and we've never had any experience of working in the office, you will adapt to working from home on a long-term basis. And if more and more people are doing that, then it's going to mean that the foot traffic to a lot of these retailers and restaurants surrounding these office buildings will just continue to drop off in the long term.
Yeah, it's going to be a permanent closure.
Yeah, and this, you know, a lot of these things, when we look at the ecosystem, we're thinking cafes and restaurants, but honestly, there are also a lot of garages and, you know, all the makcik kias that we talk about a lot, mm-hmm. they are highly impacted by this, right? Low-income families get a lot of their revenue from their income from this. And actually, they have been particularly impacted by the pandemic. And I highly encourage you to check out my grill yesterday with Dr. Mohammad Khalid. He was one of the lead researchers for UNICEF and UNFPA that studied 500 families in Kuala Lumpur and the impacts of the pandemic on them. A really good breakfast grill there. Check that out.
All right. And do let us know as well what you think about this subject. Will business ecosystems around the once thriving offices ever be the same again? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news coming up. But first, Rock With You by Michael. It's Think by Aretha Franklin. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanisen and Noel Lim. It's 6:39 a.m. Friday, the 11th of September, and we've got some international stories lined up for you this morning. First up on the list, of course, is AstraZeneca, which have said that they're still aiming for an Oxford COVID vaccine by year end. And this is after their trials were paused because one of their participants became suddenly, I think, quite ill.
Yeah, we heard this news a few days ago, which then gave a bit of, I think, shook some investors about the timeline to a vaccine. So AstraZeneca is developing a vaccine with the University of Oxford. And despite the pause, they still believe that it could be ready by the end of the year, even though one patient, I think they cited a serious neurological problem in one participant. Right now, they're trying to figure out whether it's because of the shot that they gave, the vaccine test they're testing, or because of some kind of pre-existing condition with the or some other factors that could have played into this. So that's what they're going to have to do now. I'm not sure how big the trial is itself, so that would play that would be very important into the understanding of how severe this one case is, right? Because end of the day, this is not an uncommon situation to happen with clinical trials. This is why you have clinical trials, right? So that you can see this and then you can gauge a percentage of what the side effects are and the percentage of people that might get it based on the sample that you have.
The woman who was part of the phase 3 AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine trial. Her diagnosis has not been fully confirmed yet, but she is improving according to news reports and is likely to be discharged from the hospital according to AstraZeneca. I think, they got into a call with JP Morgan, who arranged a call with AstraZeneca and some investors, and you know, Astra was saying they certainly don't want to produce a vaccine that nobody wants to take. I mean, it's certainly not very useful. So I think just to talk about how large this trial might be, I think they are looking at in the US, which is, I think they are looking at phase 3 trial in the US. They look to enroll about 30,000 participants in 80 cities across the country. And these trials earlier started in the UK, Brazil and South Africa.
Yeah, so I mean, they don't know how long this trial is going. This delay in the trial is going to be for, and AstraZeneca have come out to try and allay concerns to say that this is something that happens with vaccine trials. It's nothing unexpected, but I think what this does is that it does show how difficult it is to really get a vaccine to market, right? And everybody's been clamoring for a COVID-19 vaccine almost since the start of the year. And there are now, 180 vaccine candidates, something like that, in the world. And having seen this crop up with one of AstraZeneca's drug trials, you have to wonder a little bit about the other so-called vaccine candidates that have already been approved in other countries. Like, I think Russia is one of them, for example. Because in a lot of these cases, the safety data, the testing data is all a little bit foggy, right? You don't have full transparency over them. And at the end of the day, the usage of these vaccines comes down to trust, right? Because you have to trust that the corporation that produced the vaccine did its full battery of safety trials, and it's not going to give you some other kind of awful side effect.
And because AstraZeneca is publicly listed, so they are committed to transparency, right? Especially in working on such a high profile vaccine. And so that's the question they need to figure out now. Did the illness happen because of the vaccine, mm-hmm. or was it... Were the patients going to get it anyway? Were they going to get that illness anyway?
Yeah, so AstraZeneca is one of several drug makers taking part in the US government's attempt to accelerate the program. And this program is called Operation Warp Speed. So, Scotty, hit it.
Yes, indeed. But if we take a look at other things happening, though, in the US, it appears that ByteDance looks to be increasingly likely to miss a Trump administration deadline for the sale of its TikTok US operations after some new Chinese regulations have complicated the negotiations with Microsoft as well as Oracle Corp. Now, this is a sources story reported in Bloomberg. Now, ByteDance looks like it probably needs beyond the US executive order ban on September 20th to nail down an agreement with either party because of this regulatory review.
Am I the only one who misses the early days before a phase one deal, when all we were talking about that time was whether there would be sanctions or not and whether they could come to a deal? This has spiraled off into so many different directions. I mean, we've got the TikTok front, we've got the foreign policy front where Mike Pompeo says certain things about Hong Kong and the Uyghur situation. Then you've also got the semiconductor situation, a blacklist situation, the Huawei situation. I'm starting to lose a few marbles here and there, trying to keep up with all of this information, because these are the two largest economies, right? Now, the larger one is still the US, but China has the biggest population on earth, a billion point four at this point. They are going to determine a big part of our futures for the foreseeable future. And essentially, how they treat each other, are we going to start seeing a fragmentation of the world? We keep talking about how Malaysia needs to play both sides and, oh, we need to be able to work with the US, but also do deals with China. At some point, is that fragmentation going to make us draw a line as some other countries have?
Yes, I think this whole thing is just becoming quite disturbing, right? So FT, I think, ran a story where students were stopped at airports and they were asked to give up their passwords of access into their computer for you know, immigration officers to take a look at them. So I don't know, it's getting very disturbing.
It is, and we'll be watching this story very closely indeed. But do let us know nevertheless what you think. WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We are looking at the front pages of our own local newspapers and portals next, so stay tuned. BFM 89.9. FM 89.9, that was Wristband by Paul Simon, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. It's 6:50 in the morning, Friday the 11th of September, and we're looking at our local papers and portals this morning. I think they're all talking about Sabah, if I'm not mistaken, except perhaps for the New Straits Times.
Are you sure, Lynn? Oh,
no,
wow.
Did you call me Noel?
Yeah,
Roshan?
We're all making mistakes. Now Noel's your turn to make a mistake.
Okay, now can I go now?
Sure.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the New Straits Times. On the front page is Masjid Jamik and surrounded by water. You need to take a gondola if you want to go to Masjid Jamik now. Not now, but yesterday. And so this reminds me of Venice. But anyway, on a more serious note.
On that note, right, Noel, like, I'm wondering now whether we should be worried about a sinking city instead of Jakarta. Like, at this rate, we could be seeing a different type of sinking, right? Because some of these photos were really quite concerning. I mean, I think Masjid Jamik looked like an island on its own.
It was really quite alarming.
Surrounded by brown water.
I want to know what kind of damage was done by this flood also. I'm hoping that we get some reports on the numbers itself, because this is something, I mean, we've seen flooding in KL for ages now. I mean, earlier this week, we were talking about water shortages 5 days ago.
And now we have too much water.
And now it's too much water. What is going on? We need to sort out, irrespective of the government at play, right? Whether it was Pakatan Harapan, because they didn't do anything about this either. So, whatever, DBKL, someone sort this problem out and work out the waste, how we manage our water in this country before we enter a real proper crisis that we can't escape from.
Oh, I suppose we could be buying water from Singapore when that happens. Anyway, I'm not being facetious.
New water.
So, okay, let me tell you what happened, right? So the National Weather and Geophysics Operations Center said there was actually nothing unusual about the heavy rainfall yesterday. In fact, they said that the total rainfall at 4 p.m., the peak of yesterday's thunderstorm, was at 44.5 millimeter, which is apparently normal for an average rainy day. So actually what the real problem is, which DBKL is actually investigating, they say they think there could be various reasons, blocked drains and also some of the water from the drain area had obviously flooded into the streets. And so so they are looking into this, and hopefully we'll, you know, like you say, get a report soon.
Maybe we need to move people out of Kuala Lumpur. Maybe that's what we need to do. Wasn't Putrajaya supposed to be our new capital? Let's just get things moving there.
As the KLite.
Yes.
Okay. I have to say that.
Didn't KL have a sinkhole recently?
I think
recently?
You should just move to PJ.
Multiple sinkholes.
Putrajaya is a great place. I'm sure many people out there agree with me on this, and Noel.
Well, I do. I live in PJ.
I have to say, I'm still very fond of Kuala Lumpur. It's very hard for me to consider the prospect of moving out of it, but I do admit that the flooding situation is very bad, and let me tell you, I have stories. Okay, I've seen so many cars stuck in the middle of the road. I've seen a kanchiol float off into a drain in the middle of Kuala Lumpur.
I mean, you're selling KL great right now. I want to move there right now.
You know, there are other benefits, and this happens maybe once or twice a year, you know. Anyway, we did do a call actually on urban flooding back in July on the Morning Brief. And we spoke with Dr. Tanot Unja, who's a researcher at the Institute for Environment and Development at the University Kebangsaan, Malaysia. Look up the podcast. It's called Pouring Rain on the BFM app. So we're also taking a look at the Star this morning. And the front page here is Crumbling Partnerships. Now, this is looking at the list of candidates that have been unveiled for the Sabah state elections that are going to be happening in a couple of weeks. And it's looking at the fact that within Barisan Nasional, I think there have been some parties. So Barisan parties, Sabah UMNO, Parti Bersatu Rakyat Sabah, as well as Perikatan's Sabah Star. They've been nominating, or they've been putting out names for overlapping seats. So this
that hasn't really contributed to the clarity of the situation overall, I think, when it comes to what candidates going where in this election. But it also perhaps is a sign of the kind of tensions within the coalitions that we might not be seeing on the surface.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we've been talking about, right? Because at the end of the day, this coalition, this alliance wasn't something they came to over time. They didn't discuss the actual allocation of seats. There wasn't a... Basically, they've got no real written statement of how we're going to work this together, right? So this is going to be their first real test of whether they can work as a team. Now, on the Pakatan side, we've got the Warisan Plus situation. Warisan Plus will contest 54 out of 73 seats, and their partner, UPKO, United Progressive Kinabalu Organization, will compete in 12 seats. So they're looking to, and I think quite a lot of them are using the Warisan flag, except for PKR. PKR is using their own flag. PKR wanted to compete in 14, but they've been given 7 seats instead. So not everyone getting what they want exactly here, but at least it seems on the face of it a bit more of a cohesive plan. But I think the biggest, one of the biggest points I want to point out is the fact that Tan Sri Musa Aman was not fielded by anyone. And let's not forget that he was probably the reason all of this started when he challenged Dato' Sri Shafiq Abdal for the throne of being chief minister in Sabah.
So he set all of this in play, but then he's wound up as the one dropped from the nomination lineups.
And perhaps he didn't want to be in part of it.
Or maybe his only leverage was that, right? Like that if he could secure the seat through that switch, and now that he can't, and because he didn't... UMNO Sabah had its own plans otherwise, because I'm sure Bung Mohtar has his own strategy of how to go forward with this.
Yeah, so I think he did actually announce that he was going to be... He was looking at running in a particular seat. I can't remember which one at this point in time. But then subsequently, there were news reports quoting insider party sources saying that UMNO didn't no longer believe that Musa Aman commanded enough support in order to actually win the seat he was gunning for, because a lot of his supporters had moved to Warisan.
And then we have Parti Cinta Sabah. President Tan Sri Anifa Aman will contest in all 73 seats. So that's the younger brother of Musa Aman. And there are 1.12 million registered voters in Sabah. The EC is expecting a 70% voter turnout.
All right, and that is all of the news that we have for you from the papers this morning, because we're about to head into the 7 o'clock news bulletin. But don't go away. We're going to be looking at more business news and analysis in just a bit. So be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.